Hey everyone, welcome back to the Institute on Science for Global Policies podcast, The Forum, where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo, and to help energize this conversation today, I have with me here my two co-hosts, Aubrey and Daniela.
Hey guys, it's Daniela here, and I'm definitely all fueled up to energize this conversation.
Awesome, I'm feeling quite electrified by our subject today as well.
If you at home want to join the conversation, then power up your computers and phones and tweet us at ISGP Forum using the hashtag ISGP Forum. As always, you can also follow us on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum.
If it wasn't obvious by my co-host's rather painful puns and references, today we're going to discuss a timely topic that's relatively new to the forum, the topic of energy. As it turns out, I'm probably the most excited about today's episode, since my own chemistry research in CO2 transformations has implications for alternative energy.
Energy is indeed the name of the game today, but we'll be discussing some water infrastructure in here as well. More specifically, we'll discuss options for a more sustainably powered world and how the state of California can actually serve as a model for a potential energy transition.
The paper under discussion today comes from Dr. Neil Frommer and is titled Balancing Efficient Use with Sustainable Generation.
Dr. Frommer, the executive director of the Resnick Sustainability Institute at Caltech in Pasadena, wrote this policy position paper for the June 2015 ISGP conference titled Sustainability Challenges Coping with Less Water and Energy, held in Whittier, California.
So to set the stage for us today, I'll kick things off with a statistic that you can whip out at the dinner table. It turns out that more than 50% of the world's population lives in urban areas, and this number is increasing quite steadily each year. This is a big deal in terms of energy and water because massive urbanization trends like this one require that good water and energy infrastructure be put in place.
Meeting this requirement isn't always easy, and the strategies used to achieve reliable and robust water and energy access differ depending on whether we're talking about affluent or less affluent nations.
As you may know, less affluent nations often have limited infrastructural capacity. Now, it's pretty easy to take a Debbie Downer perspective and think that this situation is pretty bad, but it's just as easy to look at it as an opportunity. Because of the limited infrastructure already in place, it's easier to overhaul the entire system with innovative technologies before more complex development exists. In affluent countries, on the other hand, complex and inefficient infrastructure is already well established, making it much less amenable to technological innovations.
A great example of this distinction is a comparison between the current U.S. infrastructure and that of the developing island of Sumba, Indonesia. In the U.S., particularly in California, water and energy distribution systems were basically built on the premise that resources were unlimited. Instead of striving for efficiency and sustainability, we went for reliability and safety.
Reliability and safety sound like ideal goals for your infrastructure systems, though.
Oh, definitely. But these systems and the markets for their commodities were not built to handle innovation or multiple sources of water and power. So incorporating more recent advances like recycled water, solar or wind energy, and batteries is just not realistic considering how things currently stand. Not to mention that our debaters agreed that, in general, the U.S. has failed to effectively invest in its infrastructure, even for upgrades.
However, if you look at a small developing region like Sumba, where any energy infrastructure barely exists to begin with, it's much easier to choose the development of sustainable infrastructure from the get-go. In these places, simple infrastructure can potentially be upgraded by just leapfrogging over several generations of technological advances, or by building from scratch. And here's a forum fun fact. Sumba is actually trying to accomplish just that with their iconic island project, which aims to run the small Southeast Asian island on just renewable sources of energy by the year 2025. Yours truly actually helped write an article that you can Google about this endeavor.
Very cool, Cleo. Who knew you were so multifaceted in your talents?
Well, I did, but whatever.
All right, well, while Cleo basks in a little of that humble brag, let's talk a little more about the developed world's infrastructure. Despite the drawbacks in its infrastructure, the state of California is still considered a leader in the switch to renewable sources of water and energy. Germany, with its hefty investments in national solar infrastructure, and Spain, which has developed wind power, are also considered leaders in the world of renewables.
It's great that we have these places to help us see how renewable energy sources can stand as long-term stable strategies. I just dream of the day when giant wind and solar farms dominate the U.S. rural landscape.
Well, actually, Dee, as much as I would like to see that dream manifest, we're increasingly finding that a more realistic vision involves smaller commercial solar and wind projects and house-to-house adoption.
Better than nothing, I guess.
Very true. But one of the things we're still struggling with, of course, is the issue of energy storage. We've figured out that we can get all of this energy from the wind and the sun, but storing it for later use is a pretty tricky endeavor.
You can say that again. Although steady improvements are in fact being made in the realm of storage capacity. Actually, new batteries developed by Tesla are pretty promising.
More emerging technologies include geothermal and wave energy, as well as atmospheric water generation.
Atmospheric what?
Atmospheric water generation, or pulling water from the air. While I'm at it, I'll define geothermal energy as harnessing the thermal energy generated and stored in the earth, and wave energy is capturing the energy produced by waves in our oceans. These energy options, plus solar, wind, battery, and traditional electric power, all need to be a part of our menu of resources, so to speak.
Then I'll have the geothermal with a side of solar, please. And a glass of waves to top it off. Thank you, waiter.
I can't with you. I'm just going to keep going, if that's okay. It was particularly emphasized by the debaters at this conference that no single technology will be able to address consumer needs on its own. In other words, I'll use an iteration of one of our favorite ISGP phrases, a silver bullet does not exist. Solutions must instead balance a variety of technologies.
One of these solutions involves utilizing smart technology and connected devices, such as refrigerators and air conditioners.
All right, you gotta further explain this one, because right now, I'm just picturing scenes from that old Disney original movie, Smart House, where the unassuming family moves into the super smart, new age home that eventually becomes too smart and tries to trap the family inside its walls indefinitely. Now that I'm looking back on that, Disney was actually painting a pretty dark depiction of the dangers of artificial intelligence.
Oh, or how about 2001 A Space Odyssey, with HAL, the all-knowing spacecraft computer? I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that. No? No one? Well, I guess I'll thank my grad school friends later for making me watch that. I seriously hate myself right now.
Well, neither of those is what we're going for here, but thank you for that little trip down memory lane, Daniela, and for making me question your taste in movies, Aubrey. The smart technologies that I'm talking about would actually entail your household devices monitoring themselves and regulating resource delivery by sending messages about their usage so as to maximize efficiency.
It was argued, though, that this technology is currently used rather poorly. The information is shared between private energy providers and consumers, but not with those who oversee the energy infrastructure as a whole. When these data are not widely shared, they tend to concentrate in the hands of private providers who can legally use the info to manipulate markets.
This actually happened in 2011. The rolling electricity blackouts that occurred in California occurred because Enron, a former American energy commodities and service company, had more information about the availability and price of energy than any other entity.
That doesn't sound good. But unless I'm totally misjudging things, it also doesn't sound terribly hard to fix. The debaters agreed that these data have to be widely shared among all stakeholders in order to make energy systems as a whole work better. So it seems pretty important.
Potentially, but consumers have some privacy concerns and reluctance about sharing these data, even though corporations already collect masses of information about said consumers. If this energy use information could be shared anonymously, though, then we might have a solution.
There's one other conundrum we have to deal with as well, Jevons paradox.
Jevons paradox is the idea that increases in efficiency driven by technological innovations actually lead to higher consumption, not lower, as we would hope or expect.
On the flip side, efficiency driven by increased costs leads to lower consumption. While our debaters didn't seem to harp on this idea, it's worth noting that this phenomenon has been observed in several sectors.
Our debaters and presenter alike did argue, though, that on the whole, very few incentives to experiment with innovative energy solutions exist. As an example, a very small surcharge on Californians' electric bills is earmarked for research demonstrations, pilot projects, and deployment of new technologies. However, the Public Utilities Commission mandates that this already very small amount of money be spent on projects that have immediate usefulness to ratepayers.
This, in turn, severely limits the scope of possible innovations. So it'd be pretty cool if researchers had opportunities to, you know, fail. There's a great need for a space where scientists can try out new ideas and learn from results without necessarily showing immediate benefit to ratepayers of utility services.
Hey, as a scientist myself, I can totally respect that. But another limit to innovation is California's rigorous, expensive, and lengthy permitting process.
It's not all gloom, though. Let's stop dwelling on the challenges and start discussing some solutions. First off, although we in the U.S. haven't invested very well in upgrades for our infrastructure, when these upgrades do happen, it opens up some opportunities.
This is true. During these instances, we have the opportunity to replace the technology with something similar, or we can upgrade to a next-generation technology that's more adaptable to integration with multiple distribution systems, like solar, recycled water, etc.
Another way we can think about this is by taking the telecommunication system as an example.
But what does that have to do with water and energy infrastructure?
Well, you know how TV, phone, and internet all used to be accessed through separate devices?
Yeah, in like the Stone Ages. But now you can just get all that on your phone.
Exactly. They all used to be separate industries, but they changed their operations and integrated to a point where you only need one device to get all three services. Our debaters suggested that the goal of power and water systems should be similar, namely, to mimic this layering strategy so aptly utilized by telecommunication companies.
Back to that idea, though, of your home technology being able to share data so that it can be better regulated and our water and energy use can become more efficient. Well, data sharing among providers could be crucial in innovation and integration, right?
For example, if a power company knows how much solar energy is being generated, it can moderate production or create incentives for people in certain places to start using solar.
Another very cool opportunity lies within the sphere of solar photovoltaic cells, or solar panels, as some may know them as. Research actually suggests that relatively small fields of these energy harvesting devices on every continent would provide enough energy to significantly contribute to the energy grid.
Current solar panels are typically 15 to 20% efficient, which means that 15 to 20% of the energy available to them actually gets turned into electrical power. So this is kind of depressingly low. But never fear, as panels in development are expected to have higher efficiencies, maybe around 40%. These new developments not only have the potential to produce cleaner energy, but also to reduce infrastructure needs.
Which is particularly important in urban areas, where space is limited. Did you catch that seamless loop around to the urban development topic I used to open the show? Seamless.
We can't forget, though, that solar energy is kind of limited by our ability to create batteries or storage techniques for said energy. A bunch of challenges stand in our way here, including scale-up, expenses, the need for rare materials, and less than ideal environmental externalities.
Isn't another challenge the issue of competition? Could mandating renewable energy in some states make those states less competitive with the others by raising already high electricity rates?
Well, in the debate, this very point was countered by research showing that in some states, implementing sustainable energy sources actually slowed the increase in electricity rates, especially when a diverse array of energy sources was used.
Change in our more affluent nations isn't going to be sudden, but will instead evolve over time as priorities shift with new generations and new technologies. A large part of this slow evolution has to do with the challenge of the, quote, human element in the renewable energy equation.
And by human element, we mean the fact that we just don't seem to listen to what we need to be doing. Like your everyday eighth grader or me during my emo phase, humans really like to be contrarian. In other words, without sugarcoating it, it's straight up difficult to get people to actually pay attention to messaging and change their behaviors.
Because of this, Our debaters put less emphasis on the improvement of science communication and education to counter our contrarian habits, in Cleo's words, and more emphasis on developing advancements that don't require people to change their habits. The debaters also called for system-driven incentives to get ratepayers to consider reducing their energy and water consumption.
Not changing our habits as energy consumers. Well, that's convenient for us, I guess. While considering the future of water and energy delivery systems, the debaters also agreed that long-term policy solutions should take precedence over short-term and patchwork solutions.
That definitely makes sense. Because technology is always changing, policies need to be based on this premise. Basically, policies must prioritize adaptable systems that are able to easily integrate both traditional and renewable sources of energy because, remember, there's no silver bullet here for energy provision.
It's important that energy and water project goals also include reducing unwanted emissions alongside the integration of a diversity of resources and being adaptable to unknown future technologies.
But something else to keep in mind is that integrated systems like this theoretical one under discussion tend to be vulnerable to unintended consequences, as it's difficult to predict specific outcomes when pulling from both new and existing technology. Because of this, policymakers must understand any downstream effects when approving systems.
And, as usual, system development would need to be funded. Specifically, the debaters suggested that funding for technological solutions needs to be increased.
On a related note, it was also proposed that a slight increase in the amount of money that the U.S. spends on replacing worn-out parts in the power infrastructure could go towards funding the incorporation of smart components over time. This would in turn slowly but steadily increase system responsiveness and flexibility.
Well then, now you all have the latest and greatest info from our debaters on energy and water infrastructure and its much-needed improvements. So take this newfound knowledge to social media because it is your turn to weigh in.
Do you think it's fair to influence the development of power grids in less affluent nations?
If yes, should we also be monetarily supporting this development? If no, should we be concerned about the environmental or social impacts of poorly developed water and energy infrastructures overseas?
What kind of incentivization would it take you to make some energy-efficient changes in your daily behavior?
Tweet us your answers at ISGP Forum and use the hashtag ISGP Forum as well. Or catch us on our Facebook page.
Thanks so much to all of you out there for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on the Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.